Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is Jill Ajizi, and you are here with Family Matters. We are waiting for Martin Spinelli, our guest, to call in, having a little bit of technical difficulty. He's in England, and we are here. So we're doing a Cross the Water show today, and hopefully Martin will get back to us shortly. Wanted to tell you all about some things that are going on in Illinois, where I am. We have HB 2992 on third reading in the Illinois Senate right now. That bill is a bill that will allow non-custodial parents to have first right of refusal over the child in lieu of a babysitter. So that's a great bill. It's on third reading. It's got great support, and sponsors are jumping on left and right. And today at 4 o'clock, the Illinois House Judiciary Committee meets to discuss one of the provisions in HB 4158, House Bill 4158, which is a product of the Illinois Family Law Study Committee. And I serve on that committee and worked on this, revising the Illinois Marriage and Dissolution Act for the last 4 years. We've introduced that legislation in front of the Illinois legislature. And the thing we're specifically discussing today is the 35% parenting time provision. If you're listening today and you have some thoughts or some interesting information that you'd like to share with us about parenting time and how you feel that affects one of our big issues here on Family Matters, which is parental alienation, please let me know. I would love, love, love to hear from you, because this is it is kind of a hot subject. Does parenting time affect parental alienation? I mean, I have families in Wisconsin, parents in Wisconsin that are where they have 50-50 parenting time, that do not see their children at all, that are victims of severe parental alienation. So I think that I'd love to hear from all of you if you'd like to call in. I'm going to wait just a few more minutes for Martin, and we will talk to him, hopefully, yet today. This is such an interesting story. Martin Spinelli wrote a book called After the Crash, and Martin's life was transformed in September of 2006 when a trucker who fell asleep at the wheel killed his wife and nearly killed his 4-year-old son, Leo. Martin's from New Jersey originally. He's a radio producer, a writer, and a professor. And his most important and rewarding job to date is being a father to his son, Leo Spinelli. Martin is going to talk to us about how his son, Leo, pulled himself back from the edge of death and dealt with the loss of his mother, and is still probably dealing with the loss of his mother today. Leo is 11. Martin's book has become a handbook on how to use tragedy to transform one's life for the better. And who doesn't want to do that? You know, when we experience parental alienation, as so many of my listeners have, it is a continuous fight to try to work toward being better and to try to work toward not being emotionally distraught and financially ruined and all of the things that go along with being an alienated or target parent. This Martin story shows the rewards of being brave enough to trust your own instincts, to reject the words of naysayers that say, you know, give up, your child doesn't want to see you, move on, and to find your own path through all to common tragedy. It's a difficult time this time of year for many parents, and I know that I have contact every day with people whose children are graduating from eighth grade, high school, college, and they're either, you know, if they're severely alienated, they're having no contact with that child. So of course, they're not invited to the graduation. Their parents, their immediate family are not invited to the graduation. And it is a heartbreaking time for parents who are missing these incredible milestones in their child's life. And if it's ongoing alienation, you've not only missed eighth grade graduation, you've missed high school, you've missed college, and the next step, of course, is you miss your child's wedding and the birth of your grandchildren. And that sounds so dramatic and so overly sensational, but believe me, it happens every day to people as they miss these milestones. I think I have Martin here. Let's grab him. Hi, Martin. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
Thanks so much for calling in. We are on the air with Family Matters, and I was just talking to my listening audience about how incredible your book is. I've sort of done a short introduction on you, but Martin, tell me a little bit about your life and how professionally and how you're doing today and what you're doing today.
My career was really, really important to me. I was a high-flying academic, and I had lots of publications. I had my broadcast work heard around the world. I had my work archived in museums. I was really proud of myself and really accomplished, and my wife was as well. In fact, the day that the crash happened, I was scheduled to give a big keynote lecture at a huge international media conference in the north of England. And I was getting ready to do that amazing talk, and two police officers tracked me down in the lobby of my hotel, and I knew something was wrong right away because they couldn't look me in the eye, and they were a bit more nervous than I'm used to seeing police officers being. And they told me that there had been a highway accident, and that my wife had been killed, and that my son Leo was very near death in a hospital down in London. And I flew to the airport, raced to the airport, flew back down to London, and raced through the city to the hospital to find my son, my only son Leo, in pediatric intensive care, surrounded by a rainbow of life support computer screens, keeping him alive. And he had a fractured skull and severe brain damage and a terribly shattered and mutilated left leg. And the doctors told me that that he would likely not survive till morning. And in that moment, everything changed. Everything about my life and who I was and what was important to me changed in the blink of an eye.
And so immediately when you heard the news, what is that feeling like? Is it because, and I know you don't know this, but I'm going to tell you, I deal with, and this radio show was born out of a need for education and awareness for people who have lost their children in a different way, and that is through parental alienation. So people not having a relationship with their children through adversarial divorce, and in some cases, in my case, 9.5 years, haven't seen my children. We don't, you know, we're never able to grieve. We know that they're out there somewhere, but we don't have contact with them. And I know that feeling. But when you lose someone or think you're about to lose a child, what is that like? Does it suck the breath out of you? Is it something Go ahead.
When the police officers told me that Leo was near death in the hospital, it was like a physical beating. It was like being assaulted. And I remember I had my bag in my hand. I remember the bag just falling to the floor, and I remember myself just collapsing into the chair behind me. And it was as if they physically hit me. I was so completely worried and frightened and distraught, and all I could think about was the possibility of losing my son. I'd acknowledged that I'd lost my wife, but the possibility of losing my son too was just too horrendous to even contemplate. And I went through all of the textbook stages of grieving for my wife Sasha on that plane ride down to London, but also for Leo, for my son. The initial prognoses were so bad that I was really fearing the worst. And he didn't die that first night, like the doctors told me to. They actually invited me to consider donating his organs. It was that bad. But he survived. He made it through to the next morning. And I took that as a tiny, that tiny fact that he was still alive, as a grain of hope that, that anything was possible in his recovery. And the doctors very cautiously would revise up his best case scenario prognosis every couple of days. And I would say, well, you know, it's great that he survived, but he may be in a coma for the rest of his life. And then within 2 weeks, he was out of a coma. And they said, well, that's fantastic, but prepare yourself for the fact that he's probably never going to walk or talk or feed himself ever again. And he managed all of those things. And with each tiny step that he made forward, with each step he made towards the hospital door, I was able to pick up another piece of my heart. And the bond between Leo and I grew so intensely in those weeks and months in the hospital that I consider myself extremely lucky and extremely fortunate to have the kind of bond that I have with Leo right now. I think very few parents on the planet, parents and children on the planet, have the kind of relationship that I have. And it's because I almost lost him. It's because...
Don't you think that gives credence to the old adage that everything happens for a reason, and for you to be able to say that your bond was so strengthened through tragedy, I think is an incredible testament to you and to Leo.
Absolutely, I think it, you know, it really does do exactly that. It kind of, tragedy is terrible, is brutal, is horrendous, but it also focuses the mind, and it provides you a moment of clarity where you can figure out what's really important and what really matters in your life. And it's a shame that it took a disaster on the scale that we had to endure for me to come to that realization. But those weeks and months in the hospital were the making of me in many ways. I figured out what I was really meant to do, which was not be a high-flying academic with a big profile, but to be the best possible father I could be to my young son who'd lost his mother and who was in a very bad way medically.
I like that you kind of tuned out in the book. You talk about tuning out the doctors because they were coming at you constantly with negative comments about what could happen, what could happen, what could happen. But you shut them out and you hoped and prayed and kept your faith for what could happen, the possibilities for recovery. How did, when you felt faith slipping away, how did you pull yourself back to a place where you knew that you could go on and be hopeful and positive?
You know, it's uncanny. It's really, really strange. But I remember the last words that my wife said to me when she dropped me off at the train station to head up to this conference. She said, "Don't let pessimistic people get you down," which was an incredibly odd thing to say because we had that kind of goodbye 100 times before at that train station, and she never felt the need to say anything like that to me before. We'd said goodbye in exactly that way so many times. It was part of what we did. But there was something really heavy and really different about this one particular goodbye. And she said, "Don't let pessimistic people down," which was odd because I always kind of thought of ourselves as, you know, if not pessimistic, certainly a little bit cynical and a little bit jaded and kind of and sophisticated and not suffering fools lightly. But I, in those dark days in the hospital, I just remembered what she said. This throwaway comment out of nowhere, apropos of nothing, I remember her words, "Don't let pessimistic people get you down." And I would say it to myself like a little mantra. And, it really did help. But it wasn't really a conscious decision, but I found myself meditating on this vision of Leo walking out the hospital door and of Leo having a normal childhood, doing all those things, going on camping trips and building forts and going on hikes and playing football. Went over and over these pictures in my mind of him doing these happy, normal childhood things. when I was feeling really frightened and burnt out and scared, and it worked. I mean, it just helped me kind of pull myself back up, and I would also remind myself of the fact, well, you know, at least I had Leo. I didn't know what state he was going to be in at the end, but I had him. I had him in my life, and man, did I appreciate that fact like I'd never appreciated it before.
You had some really interesting experiences while you were there with Leo, and how long was he actually in the hospital?
Just under 3 months. He was just under 3 months in the hospital.
Okay, and Go ahead.
No, I've had the experiences that we had in the hospital were, they were so intense and so surreal, some of them, and the relationships you build in a situation like that in pediatric intensive care, especially in pediatric intensive care, this particular hospital did most of the liver transplants, the pediatric liver transplants. In Great Britain, and just kind of having Leo there with his terrible brain damage but his perfectly good four-year-old liver, and having doctors say, you know, think about donating his organs, it just throws you into a space that you never ever expected you would be in. And the relationships that we built with the other families in the hospital were incredibly intense, and there were children that made it, and there were children that didn't make it, and there were families that came and then left and then came back again while we were still in the hospital, and I'm still in contact with so many of those people from that very, very intense period in all of our lives. It really kind of forged a connection that that I didn't expect, and you know, as I was praying for the children of other families in my own way, you know, other families were praying for Leo to do well in their own traditions, mm-hmm. in their own languages, and you know, it was an incredible experience.
It's interesting that you can have that common bond with people that you don't know. You're all there for the same end goal, to take home a healthy child. And in that process, you end up becoming fast friends and sharing experiences together, and then having these long-lasting friendships, which you just alluded to. So I think that's wonderful that through tragedy and adversity, you found, you know, support and friendship and fellowship within the Children's Hospital.
Absolutely, yeah. I couldn't have said it better than that. You know, it does, as a bond was forged between Leo and I, a bond was forged between us and these other families. And, you know, it's at that moment when you almost have everything taken away, like I said, you know, there's this opportunity for figuring out what's important, and when it's not just you, but other people also doing that same kind of soul searching, and mm-hmm. Also being confronted with the possibility of losing their child, and reflecting on their own lives and their own careers and their own decisions that they've made about spending time with family versus investing time in career, you don't leave a situation like that unscathed, and I would say virtually all of the people that I'm in contact with now from that period have a very different understanding of the value of family, and their relationships between themselves and their children are strengthened and much more meaningful to them than I think they were. I don't think that's an unfair characterization. I think almost everyone I know went through some kind of profound change in their own way, in their own experience.
You tell some different stories about bonds that you've made, but I want you specifically to talk about the Middle Eastern man that you encountered and the belt. Can you talk about that story a little bit? It's very, very poignant to me, and I'm sure our listeners would love to hear the bond that you forged with this man.
This was a day or two after Leo had been admitted to hospital, I met in an elevator in the hospital, a man with the heavy Middle Eastern accent, and he was holding up his pants, and he wanted me to see that he was holding up his pants. And he started talking to me in a very thick accent, and I was in a terrible emotional state myself. And he said that they took everything. They took everything. They even took my belt. And it turns out that while this man was in the hospital donating a part of his own liver to save his son, to save his young son, somebody had taken the opportunity to rob him, to rob his house, and to take everything that he had. And I was just so completely shocked and appalled by this. I mean, our tragedy was a tragedy, but it was an accident. You know, the truck driver that fell asleep at the wheel and crashed into the back of my wife's car and killed her and almost killed our son, he didn't want to do it. He didn't think about doing it ahead of time. He didn't imagine he would gain something by it. He fell asleep. It was an accident. But here, standing in front of me, holding up his pants, was this evidence that that real evil is out there, that there are people who would rob someone in the midst of an incredibly intense and painful and frightening experience, the likes of which very few people can imagine. And it kind of woke me up to lots of stark realities in the world, and woke me up to the fact that, you know, there were other people who were also suffering in a very, very profound way all around me. And my encounter with this man, who I later would meet a number of times in the hallways, and would always kind of go out of my way to ask him how he was doing and ask him how his son was doing and to buy him a cup of coffee, my perception of humanity, the way I related to people, the fact that I kind of realized that I wasn't in this alone, that there were lots and lots of other people who were going through tremendously terrible things, was also a kind of growing experience for me, there are people out there who you can help even when you're feeling at your rock bottom. You know, there's always somebody out there who's in a worse situation than you, and you might be able to do something for them. And that was something that came out of this encounter with the man with the missing belt.
Do you find yourself wanting at this time? I mean, how long has it been since the accident?
6 years and 7 months.
6 years, 7 months, 3 hours and 42 minutes, right?
It's, yeah.
that's how we count alienation. Do you find yourself becoming an activist for this issue, for falling asleep at the wheel or for drunk driving or
yeah.
for anything that it, do you? You're speaking out about
absolutely.
These issues?
Absolutely. I mean, I've done a lot of work raising awareness about the dangers of distracted driving, and I've been involved with campaigns here and also done a lot of work in the States. April was Distracted Driving Awareness Month in the States. And I spent a lot of time on radio and on TV and writing pieces in magazines and newspapers about what happens if you let yourself get distracted behind the wheel. And, you know, just inviting people to think about balancing their own need to get things done and be productive while they're driving on using their phones or whatever,
right.
with the danger that that causes and the potential catastrophe that can happen to a family when you're not paying attention to what you're doing. Part of the book is an attempt for me to reach out to the truck driver who was sentenced to 2.5 years in prison for causing death by dangerous driving. I wanted to get him a letter. I wrote him a letter And it turns out that just before I was able to send it to him, he was released from prison, and he was Belgian, so he was repatriated back to Belgium after serving 6 months of his sentence. And he dropped off the radar of the probation service, and I didn't know what to do with this letter because I was desperate to get it to him, because it was my effort to try and communicate to him that I didn't bear him any ill will, that I recognized that something terrible had happened to our family, but something terrible had also happened to him and his family, and that I appreciated that he didn't want to do it. It was an effort at reconciliation and trying to just kind of figure out if he was going through the same things that I was going through, missing his family in prison like I was missing mine. And that's another, you know, I'm really big on forgiveness and trying to figure out a way to shed anger and to not kind of carry it around with you, because it can be really, really self-destructive. I went through a really angry patch, and it didn't really serve me. And I think, you know, for me, in my case, figuring out how to get rid of all of that emotional baggage and close that chapter in my life was really important, and helped me move on.
So did you ever find him? Never, right?
No. No, the letter is in the book, and you know, part of After the Crash is a tribute to Leo, a record to Leo, a document for him that he can read when he's older and learn about how brave and strong and tenacious he was and what a wonderful person his mother was. But, you know, it was also kind of a message in a bottle, almost, a kind of the hope that maybe one day the book would find its way into the truck driver's hands somehow, and he'd read the letter, and he might be able to sleep a bit better himself.
Yeah, and chances are probably good, and I think you would probably echo this, that he fell off the face of the earth because he is just racked with guilt and feeling horrible about the accident that he caused. And it's a shame that he could not have the same opportunity to embrace healing like you did. And I think this book would really do that for him.
Yeah. I mean, that's my hope. And he was distraught. I mean, I wasn't at the sentencing hearing because I had to be in the hospital and wanted to be in the hospital. I didn't really want to get involved with the legal process. But apparently he was very emotional at the sentencing hearing and went away with tears in his eyes.
Yeah. Oh, I want to go back just a second to what I asked you about the advocacy, and you said, you know, you've done some work in creating awareness and educating, and earlier you had said you kind of, after this happened, you sort of reevaluated who you were, what you were, how you were going to live your life, and there's a line in the book that says, before the crash, you were an academic with clever dinner party conversation and a well-stamped passport. Did any of that, what you had before, being somebody, did that help you gain access to avenues that you thought might not be open to you to educate and awareness and news outlets and things like that to help you further your campaign?
I not so much my old profile, but my old skills, I think, at talking to people and being able to write a press release and knowing what media outlets want and things like that. That was all really useful in reaching out and in helping make a contribution to Distracted Driving Awareness Month. You know, it was certainly useful. I mean, I could not have reached as many people without that past history, without that past training. And similarly, you know, the book wouldn't have happened after the crash, you know, wouldn't have been written, I don't think, had I not been a writer before. I'd written lots and lots of articles and did lots and lots of newspaper stories and magazine stories and radio stories. But, you know, the writing in After the Crash is very, very different. I mean, it was the first time that I actually reflected on my own feelings rather than reported someone else's. It was the only time where I kind of really took a hard look at my place in the world and what was important to me, rather than bandying about abstract ideas about radio art or media law or the legality of new file formats and things like that. So, I shifted from being very esoteric and very abstract in my writing to being much more concrete and accessible and real. And I feel really good about that now. And when I do write things now, I continue to write in that mode because it's a mode that reaches people. It's a mode that is accessible to people. Human stories are just, especially human stories of recovery at times like this, are really important and really valuable in a way that no kind of amount of abstract statistical analysis could ever be important.
Of course, we're talking about the book After the Crash, which Martin wrote to. Why did you write it? What was your vision for the book? And what, as other than it being cathartic for you, what was the end goal of this book? And you've touched on it. For Leo and for the truck driver and for everybody involved and very close to you in your inner circle to read it and understand it. But what was your vision?
It's funny because I didn't really have a vision at the beginning. I had a website. I had a blog, which I kept. I started a few weeks after the crash as a just a very efficient way of keeping everybody informed back home, and I had friends all over, keeping friends and family informed about what was going on, about how Leah was doing, about what we were going through. And I was in this new way, being really, really honest and really, really open and very candid about what I was feeling and what we were going through and the really impossibly difficult decisions we were facing. And grieving about Sasha. And one day towards the end of our stay in the hospital, one of Leah's neurologists came in and he said, "You know, Martin, you've got this incredible story of recovery here, which has really stupefied me and a lot of my colleagues. And you write about it really well. And I and other doctors have been sharing the website address with other families who are going through similar situations in this hospital and in other hospitals. And, you know, it's already helped and motivated and given a sense of hope to other people. You should really think about doing something beyond just the website. You should really think about turning it into a book." And I was flattered and I thanked him. But, you know, at the time I was very, very focused on just getting Leo out of the hospital and making a transition from hospital to school and finding surgeons for his leg. But as I kept blogging over that first year after the crash, the comments from complete strangers around the world just came flooding in about how they had been moved by the story of this amazing four-year-old and his recovery from near death, and how they'd been touched by his own ability to empathize with the plight of the truck driver, and how we dealt with things like burying Sasha's ashes, and I just kept getting the love. I mean, it was simple love from strangers in corners of the world that I'd never been to, and I thought, okay, yeah, now is the time with Leo out of the worst of his medical situation. Maybe I can find a bit of time to turn the blog into a book, and that's precisely what I did. And the goal, I mean, you asked about, you know, what the goal was, aside from leaving a document for Leo, aside from kind of trying to reach out to the truck driver, I did want to make good what that neurologist had said when he stuck his head into Leo's room, that, you know, it's already helped people and could help a lot more people. And I really like the fact that our story might give people some hope at a time when they really need hope. That makes me feel good, and that was the motivation for doing it.
And I think, Martin, it transcends just a child in the hospital or someone who has someone, you know, a family member who isn't doing well in the hospital. This book is really great for any situation of tragedy or adversity. It applies to our situation with parental alienation or divorce. I think it is just a strong story of courage and love, and really it elicits a rainbow of emotions as you read through it. It's an amazing work, and I think you did a terrific job.
That was really kind of you. Thanks for saying so.
You're welcome. Let's talk about Sasha, because we haven't talked about her too much. You know, one thing I felt about Sasha in the book is that you were one of those couples that you would look at and say, oh my God, they are so much in love. You know, it must have been love at first sight. Or, you know, that's how I felt. And so you have to tell me if that's true. Tell me a little bit about her.
She was amazing. She was utterly fantastic. She was clever. She was fun. She was an incredible dancer. She was a really accomplished academic and an artist and a musician. And we met in graduate school in England at a joke cricket match. And it was, you know, it was love at the first ball, really. I was the bowler, the pitcher, and she was the wicketkeeper, the catcher, and that was it, really. We fell in love instantly, and we courted through letters, and we spent a lot of time on different sides of the ocean. Me being American, her being British, and I cherish those letters now. She was really a fantastic mother as well. She was a really, really accomplished academic, and she was writing when she died a book about beauty, and she was going to write a popular book about beauty, trying to kind of save the idea of beauty from the mouths of a lot of academics that just kind of dismiss it as a silly concept, really. And she was trying to kind of revive it and reinvigorate it and identify beauty as experience and create a sense of energy and enthusiasm in people. Some of those bits of writing in that book that she never finished found their way into After the Crash. I used them at the beginning of each of the sections and each of the four parts of the book. And some of them are incredibly uncanny because they talk about death, and beyond that, they talk about a small child, which was Leo. She was talking about our son not knowing death, but knowing that he still loved his mother. And it was another kind of odd moment, like that moment at the train station, which I can't really explain in a rational way. But it seemed as if she was almost aware that something was going to happen. I'm really, really incredibly glad and grateful that she left those fragments of that book behind, and I'm really pleased that I was able to include them in After the Crash. She was a remarkable woman, but we did have our fights.
It wasn't perfect. It wasn't all a bed of roses.
No, it wasn't. You know, we did fights. I mean, everybody fights. Most of our fights, in fact, all of them had as their root the question of where we were going to finally settle down. I was developing my career in the States. She was developing her career in Britain. I had family in the States. She had family in Britain. Every single fight that we had to do with this kind of unstated open question about where we were going to finally settle down. And, you know, it did kind of creep into fights about where we would spend our vacation time and you know, even what restaurant we would go to when we were going out of an evening. But, you know, we kind of it sorted itself out in that I ended up getting a job, a good job in Britain. But you know, it wasn't all a bed of roses.
Well, that's good to know, I guess, because when it seems perfect, it isn't always, right? So there's always little issues. Nobody has a clean closet. What you talk about, Sasha, being agnostic in the book, did you develop any kind of organized religion in your life after you were married?
You know, I was at the time I was culturally Catholic, I had a connection to that through my family, and it was important to me in a kind of traditional way. Sasha adopted my Catholicism with honestly more vigor than I had at the moment at that time. And you know, she converted to Catholicism before we got married. In her last days, you know, I'm sure that she prayed more than I did, and you know, I'm sure most of her prayers were probably about getting pregnant again, because she was we both really wanted another child. You know, after the crash happened, I was given another opportunity to kind of reassess my own faith and my own position in relationship to that tradition, and I'm a much more spiritual person now than I was before the crash. I don't avoid conversations about faith. I consider myself a modern Reformed Catholic, but I'm much more Catholic now than I was before, and you know, I'm also much more charitable with other people's ideas about faith and about the hereafter and about religion and about a whole range of metaphysical things, like I never used to be, and I think that's good too. You know, I'm much more kind of gentle and open with those kinds of discussions than I used to be, and it's a much more important part of my life.
And I think it's really freeing as well. I mean, don't you feel much less stressed and much if you feel that way about there's somebody higher than you that you can go to get answers and ask questions, and if you're open to other people's ideas, it seems that you are much freer. I don't know a better word to say, but you sort of have elevated yourself to a level where you're above the fray of fighting and everything that goes on in the world on a daily basis that tends to bog people down and doesn't allow them to live a life of purity.
Exactly. I think a lot of it has to do with kind of being... you know, being attached to particular codes that you feel like you have to sign in blood, or someone signed in blood for you, and you know, I think a lot of my adolescent resistance to religion and kind of rejection of my family tradition, which you know, spanned up into my 20s, was about kind of rejecting the kind of fear and the dogma that was a part of my very quite orthodox religious upbringing. You know, I kind of went the other direction until the crash happened. And then, you know, the crash was an opportunity for me to discover the valuable parts of my family tradition, was an opportunity for me to figure out what worked for me in that faith and in that tradition. That has been a tremendous asset for me, and is exactly as you say, it's liberating when you kind of come to it as an adult, when you come to that kind of awareness and openness where you are able to hear what other people are saying without kind of instantly refuting it or instantly rejecting it, where you are able to try and find what works for you in what somebody else is saying, I think that's a very high. It's a very mature place to be, and I think if more people around the world were able to kind of get to that level of maturity, we'd have a lot less strife and fighting both at home and abroad.
You're absolutely right about that. I want to talk about just for a second, when you came to the point where you eventually had to begin legal proceedings, and that certainly wasn't the first thing on your mind, although there are litigious people out there and they want to get what they can. So you have people who were coming to you saying, you know, we need to get that guy, get the bastard, let's get him, put him away for a long time. How did you feel about that when people were coming to you with this plan that you were going to go to court and really get this guy good?
You know, I didn't want any part of it. I recognized very early on that I had a limited amount of emotional energy, and I just didn't want any part of this idea of retribution. You know, I was angry, but I was also very focused on getting Leo out of the hospital, and I knew that the more I got involved in what was going on in the court case, the less energy I would have for Leo, and the less strength I would have, the less energy I would have to put to the thing that mattered most to me, which was my relationship with Leo and getting Leo out of the hospital. So I did what the police asked in good faith, found the documents that they needed, provided them the statements that they needed, gave them access to the files that they needed to make their case against the driver. I also wrote a victim statement. The police asked me to write a statement which explained how the crash had affected my life and changed my life. And when they originally asked me to do it, I almost laughed because you know the change was so complete and absolute and total. You know, one hardly knows where to begin. It was my understanding that these victim statements were read by the judge in his chamber before the sentencing. But the victim statement that I wrote ended up being read in open court because the judge found it very, very strong and very, very moving. And I didn't expect that. I didn't even want that. There were some reporters in the court because it was quite a big case here in England, much of my victim statement got printed in the newspapers the next day, the national papers, and it was a very weird scene because my family was worried that I would be upset about seeing my victim statement in the newspapers because they had assumed, like I had assumed, that you know it was just going to be something that the judge would read in private. The police seemed to think that it was a huge success that it was read in open court because it meant that it was a very, very strong statement. And I ended up including that statement in after the crash. So my victim statement is in the book, and it's one of the passages in the book that I will go back to now and read just to remind myself of how much I've moved on and how much we've moved on and how my concerns then were really desperate and really crisis management and my grief was really profound, and it's nice to be able to contrast that every now and again with the life that I have now, which is much, much better and more fulfilling.
Let's talk about the life you have now. Where are you and Martin, or are you and Leo now?
We're still in England. Leo is He's in the what would be the fifth grade, and he's about to go to middle school. He goes to middle school next year. He's doing amazingly well. To see him playing with his friends on the playground, you would not know anything. Anything had happened. I mean, he looks normal. He acts normal. He plays with his friends. He's got lots of friends. He plays soccer on Saturday mornings. He plays the piano to a really, really high level. He just did his grade 3 piano exam. And last year in school, he's doing really, really well in school, in math especially. He beat the high score of his school principal on a math times table challenge online test, which he was really proud of. You know, we're not out of the woods yet. There are still some issues that have to be dealt with. He's got some speech and language issues, which we're dealing with, but which I'm convinced will be
overcome.
Behind us before he's an adult. And his leg, his left leg isn't growing, his left thigh isn't growing because of the accident, so he needs periodically to have it lengthened and straightened with an external frame that's on his leg for 5 or 6 months. And that's extremely painful and torturous for him. So we have that to deal with probably again in a year, a year and a half's time. But to look at us now, you know, we're really good and we're really happy. And I'm really, really grateful for every moment with Leo.
How do you or do you keep Sasha's memory alive to Leo?
But in lots of ways. When she died, we set up a scholarship fund at the University of Kent, where she was a professor, and that every year we raise money for the Sasha Roberts Scholarship Fund, and we give a scholarship to someone who's studying in one of the fields that Sasha was interested in. Our house is full of paintings that she did of Leo, and full of photos of us all together, and we often get down the family photo albums from before the crash and just spend a half an hour reminding ourselves of where we came from and all the wonderful things we did with his mother. So she's very much a part of our lives still.
That's very important to let him know where he came from, and I assume that her parents are pretty involved in Leo's life, as are yours.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, next week is Leo's spring break, and we're going out to spend a week in Italy with Leo's grandparents, Sasha's parents, and that'll be really nice. We're going to the place that we've gone to now in Italy for many, many years, and it's going to be a nice family vacation. And then this summer we're going to be back in the States, spending a bit of time with my mother, who lives in New Jersey, all three of them were very, very, you know, important in Leah's recovery. They were all very hands-on in getting him out of the hospital, and it's been really important for all of us as we move through the loss of Sasha and Leah's medical issues to kind of stay close and stay together and to support each other when we need it.
Well, what an amazing story you have, Martin, and I just applaud you for pulling yourself up out of adversity and bringing you and Leo to this point in your life where you're so incredibly happy and have this wonderful bond. The book is After the Crash. How can we buy the book, Martin?
It's available on Amazon. It's also available at Barnes & Noble's, and anywhere that sells books can order you a copy. It's available also in all of the ebook formats on Kindle and iTunes and Kobo. So it's pretty easy to get.
And it was a UK bestseller, apparently. So
it
that's
was, yeah,
terrific.
It made it onto the... It made it onto the bestseller list, the nonfiction bestseller list in the UK last year, and it turned out to be my publisher's best-selling book of 2012, which made me really, really happy. It made me happy for a lot of reasons. It beat the Simon Cowell biography, which I was perhaps perhaps happier than I should have been about it, but I was pretty happy about it. But it's nice. It was kind of reassuring for me that there is an appetite for these positive, uplifting human stories.
Yes.
Still, I think it's been a really heartening and uplifting experience for me, just kind of getting the message out about Leah's amazing recovery and hearing the response and the reception that the book has gotten in Britain and now in the U.S.
Well, it's such an amazing handbook for dealing with disaster. And again, it applies at every level. I mean, I can think of it should be handed out in Oklahoma today to the people who have suffered such loss there over the last couple of days with the devastating tornadoes. I don't know if you've kept up on all of that in the UK, but it's just been a horrible thing, leveling two schools and killing some children. And it's just been horrible. But this book is a perfect book for that, because there are so many people who are grieving and hurting and wanting answers, and After the Crash should be a must read for anyone who wants to make the turn from heartbreak into a positive, meaningful life. And I appreciate you so much, Martin, and we will look for your next good read. When's the next book coming out?
Probably 2014, and it's going to be a book about fatherhood and being a father.
Oh, well, I want to interview you on that one, because that is so important. I hope
you'll
release it around Father's Day. Let Stephanie know I want to talk to you, because I do have I'm looking at loads and loads and loads of files on fathers who aren't seeing their children, fathers who have lost their children, fathers who haven't had relationships with their own fathers. So what a great book, and we will look forward to hearing from you on that. I appreciate you so much for calling all the way from England today and taking time out of your busy schedule, and we will look forward to hearing from you again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Martin. Everybody have a good day. Watch Illinois Legislature Judiciary Committee today. We're working on that great bill for 35% shared parenting time and hoping that sails through the legislature. Everybody have a great, great Memorial Day. We will see you soon. This is Family Matters. I'm Jill Ajizi. Thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Jill. Bye.
Bye, Martin. Thanks.